Blog Talk Radio.
About the election.
And we got Larry Dorman joining us, Ask the Union. Who's going to, in a little while, he's going to talk to us about the overall.
He'll talk to us particularly about Connecticut and our race here for governor and other offices, but then I'm sure he'll comment on the national scene too.
Yeah, we really much, we won the local election, the governor of Connecticut, which we're grateful for, Democrats, but, man, we really blew it as far as national.
We got creamed.
Whoa. So,
even in our neighboring state, Massachusetts, they elected
there went Republican.
Republican, too, which was kind of odd.
Unbelievable.
But they tend to do that up there. They often have Republican
governors. They're kind of a schizophrenic state, you know, and are bipolar, one or the other. But anyway, the defining narrative of this election was confirmation, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that Americans are desperate for a new economic life, said AFL-CIO President Richard Trumka on Wednesday. After a disappointing election night, Trumka held a press conference to discuss the election and released the results of a poll conducted by Hart Research Associates that looked into the story behind the headline. He said the voters made it clear they want an economy that works for everybody. Yeah. So let's talk to him. So let's listen to his 3-minute speech here.
Gonna turn that up.
Well, Democrats took a licking yesterday, but the workers' agenda sure didn't. In fact, it shines brighter today and is even more urgent. Voters spoke very clearly in yesterday's election. They want an economy that works for them and works for their families. Now, data show that more people heard an economic message from Republicans than Democrats. It was a lousy message. Only 29% think that Republicans have a clear plan for the economy. But it was presented clearly and strongly, and in tough times, some people responded to that. They responded because they're hurting. And that's what our election polling showed. 68% want a raising wage agenda. 62% want to raise the minimum wage. 61% support an increase in Social Security benefits. On issue after issue, when voters really heard our message, they embraced it. In too many elections, they got a false choice. In these difficult times, they did not get a genuine economic alternative to their unhappiness and real fear of the future. And it's noteworthy that voters rejected the tired Republican ideas. 54% oppose reducing Wall Street regulations. 66% oppose raising the Social Security retirement age. 76% oppose raising the Medicare eligibility rate. In fact, when voters did have a choice, have a chance to choose their future directly through ballot measures, the decisions were unmistakable. Minimum wage increases were overwhelmingly approved. None of them lost yesterday. The same is true for paid sick leave and other parts of the raising wages agenda. Now, I was out there all fall. I was in almost every contested state, and I spoke to hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of workers. And their desire for bold, comprehensive, and lasting economic change is the most real thing that I've heard. Going forward, it's pretty simple. Politicians got to be with working people rather than asking them to be with politicians. This poll that you'll see is really an agenda. It's a roadmap for anybody to follow. And that's where we're going to be in the upcoming months. This election actually erases all the ambiguities, all the maybes and the sort ofs and all the tinkering around. We intend to define the terms of the debate very clearly in the months ahead and use the words of voters to do it with.
I agree with him. Great, Mr. Trunka. But, you lost,
The ballot initiative.
The ballot initiative you won, but you lost the damn elections.
That's very disappointing.
The defining narrative of this election was confirmation, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that Americans are desperate for a new economic life.
I think that's true. They were really disappointed in what happened in Congress.
But after a disappointing election night, Trump held a press conference and discussed the election and released the results of a poll conducted by Hart Associates that looked at the story behind the headlines. And he said voters made it clear that they want an economy that works for everyone.
Well, here I can specifically tell you what happened. Voters approved increases.
I was going to continue this thing.
But I have it right here that says what happened. Voters approved increases to the minimum wage in Alaska, Arkansas, Illinois, Nebraska, South Dakota, as well as Oakland and San Francisco, California. In victories for working women and families, voters in Oregon approved the equal pay measure, and in Massachusetts, a measure calling for up to 40 hours a year of paid sick leave for employees was approved. Paid sick leave measures in Oakland, California, Montclair, and Trenton, New Jersey also won. Measures to strengthen voting rights were approved in Missouri, Montana, and Illinois. New York voters passed Proposal 3, an education funding initiative, and in Missouri, Amendment 3, which would have weakened due process for teachers and would take control of local schools away from parents and teachers and school districts, was defeated. In Anchorage, Alaska, voters defeated AO 37, which would have introduced right-to-work-for-less measures in the city and prevented collective bargaining for city employees. California voters also struck a blow to unfair laws and passed Proposition 47, dealing with mass incarceration and unfair sentencing for nonviolent crimes. Important tax and budget ballot initiatives won approval in Alaska, Illinois, and North Dakota. Transportation funding measures were approved in Maryland, Rhode Island, and Wisconsin. Clayton County, Georgia voters approved a contract with public transportation provider MARTA. So that's what he's talking about. He's talking about ballot initiative and what happened.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, we kind of lost the...
Here in New Jersey, which I thought was great, because I hate this guy, Chris Christie. But
yeah, Governor.
New Jersey Union member Donald Norcross elected to Congress. The New Jersey labor movement made history tonight by electing our union brother, Donald Norcross, a member of Electrical Workers, a local 351, to the U.S. Congress. This would not only have been possible without thousands of union members who volunteered each week leading up to the election.
It would not have been possible.
Yeah. Well, we also congratulate Senator Cory Booker on his election to a full term in the U.S. Senate and applaud the election of 31 labor candidates, bringing the total to 814 election victories through our labor candidate program. Well, very, 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 very good. I'm very pleased to hear that.
It must have been state.
Yeah, state and
state houses and state senates.
Yeah. New Jersey labor movement was strong and united throughout the campaign season, securing important victories at every level of government. Well, Central Labor Councils, Building Trade Councils, and thousands of volunteers from affiliate unions made the State Labor 2014 program one of the most successful in the country. A total of 291,725 union members' homes were visited this election cycle. Labor volunteers assembled packets, staffed phone banks, and participated in labor walks, making these election victories possible. A strong labor movement gives unions the power to elect the right people to represent us, and working together in solidarity, union members made the difference.
We commend Roy Chow, Amy Belgard, and Janice Kovach for championing the rights of New Jersey's working families and upholding our shared middle-class values, though they did not prevail. We congratulate the returning members of Congress on their victories and look forward to seeing many new elected union members take the oath of office and continue moving our state forward, said New Jersey State AFL-CIO Secretary-Treasurer Laurel Brennan. Thank you for your tireless efforts in making these historic victories possible.
So screw Chris Christie, and may the AFL-CIO keep running.
Yeah,
you
and
know
take
I mean?
Him out on the net.
Yeah, I hope so. Good God.
Keep up the good work.
Yeah.
I just couldn't stand it. He was coming to Connecticut all the time.
No, he was plaguing us every week. And I'm so glad the Connecticut people voted for a Democratic Malloy.
I was afraid
governor.
If we got Foley, he'd be visiting all the time.
Oh, I'd be sick to see that fat ass.
I hate to get personal, but he's just...
Horrible.
Bully.
Guy. Oh, God. So anyway, I'm going to let Lila read. You want to read Winners and Losers of the Week here? But we're going to call Larry Dorman, Public Affairs Coordinator for ASME Union, and we're going to talk with him tonight and see what he's... He's kind of happy that Connecticut won, but
he's
a little discerned that they got kind of slumped throughout the nation. But
I mean, it shows what a good job Connecticut workers did.
Yeah,
you had to get the word out. In their regular work weekly feature, they talk about the winners and losers in the struggle for workers' rights. The winners: Oakland and San Leandro recycling workers, after a week-long strike that led to the low-wage workers winning a contract guaranteeing living wages and affordable health insurance. Runner-up, Arthur King III, the winner of the 2014 U.S. National Boilermaker Apprenticeship Competition. Loser, fast-track supporters in Congress, who are planning a sneak attack during the lame duck session while everyone else is focused on the election. And runner-up, Cornerstone Janitorial Services, for allegedly underpaying and exploiting undocumented workers. Yeah, that sucks. So, you
Hello.
Give it...
Larry here. Hopefully you'll join us.
Guy must be exhausted. He's been out every day since... So hopefully we'll get a hold of him. They might be having a celebration after all of this.
You've reached the voicemail of Larry Dorman, Council 4, Public Affairs. Please leave your name, number, and a brief message, and I'll get back to you as soon as possible. Thanks.
At the tone, please record your message. When you have finished recording, you may hang up or press 1 for more options.
Larry, it's the L.A. Steel Show.
Yes, we have Lila. You're supposed to be available at this point, so give us a call.
Give us a call. Let us.
And call us at, 646-915-9505 as soon as you're available, okay?
Give him a call again.
All right. 646-915-9505, okay?
All right.
We'll wait for your call.
So he might be, you know how cell phones work sometimes.
Yeah. So well, he'll be available in a few seconds.
I'm sure he'll either call us or we'll get back to him.
Yeah.
In the meantime, what else do we have?
Well, we've got a lot of stuff because, a lot of stuff happened. We felt really really, really bad for unions because, man, you know, when you...
I don't know what happened there. I didn't do anything. I guess I must have leaned on something. There.
So anyway.
That was kind of weird, wasn't it?
Did we read this? Winners and losers of the week?
Yes, I just did. Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
So
smug.
Oh, I bet Mitch McConnell is feeling.
Well, actually, I saw him. He was rather humble.
Really?
Yeah, well, not humble, but rather something today. I was rather pleased to see him not quite so arrogant. But there's something you got to know. The guys running against us aren't nice guys. I hate to say it, but they're already passing around champagne. These aren't the kind of people we want as our leaders. They think they're better than us because they eat at fancy restaurants and lobbyists and wear expensive suits. They think they're freeloaders because
they think we're freeloaders.
Because they want benefits we've earned. And they're laughing all the way to the bank as they run away with big donations from fat cat donors like the Koch brothers. Well, it doesn't matter where you come from, what your education level is, or how much money you make. What matters is good old-fashioned American values, keeping your family healthy, putting food on the table, and maybe having a little leftover on the weekend. Well, we're not asking for much, just enough to live our lives, and guys like Scott Walker, Rick Scott, and Mitch McConnell think we don't deserve it, even as they rake in the big bucks. These are guys who are worth tens of millions of dollars. What do they know about working families? Are we going to let these smug faces win? Well, dig deep and let's send these guys packing once and for all. The best way you can help send these guys home is to make sure that your friends and neighbors show up and vote tomorrow. This obviously didn't happen because these bastards won. All right? Larry's on the line here, so let's hang on a second.
So hold on there, folks.
Okay. Hi, guys.
Hi,
hey, Larry.
How are you?
Good. Sorry, I couldn't pick up right away.
Ding, huh?
A little bit.
Yep.
Did you have some?
Can you hear me okay? What's that?
Yeah, you with us, Larry?
I'm there.
Did your folks have a celebration down there at Council 4?
A little bit, you know, a little bittersweet. You know, Connecticut at least kind of bucked the national trend in terms of the outcome, electoral outcome. But, you know, nationwide it was not a great day.
No,
not at all. But that was a close vote for Daniel Malloy, but not quite as close as last time around, believe it or not.
Right. He actually got about four times as many votes in the end. So I think he did considerably better this time around. It just took a while to, you know, queue up the results, I guess.
I think he came on strong toward the end of the cycle there. He was more specific, he was more sure of himself, and really Foley didn't reveal any plans that he had.
Well, you know, Larry, I almost called you on Sunday morning doing that.
Yeah, you should have.
Doing that debate. Did you watch that by any chance?
I did, yeah.
Yeah, wasn't it great? Malloy really knocked Foley out, I thought, on that one.
He did, and, you know, I mean, I think toward the end of the campaign, Foley just became, like, too easy to beat up, you know?
That's true. Foley looked like a schmuck, I'll tell you, after that. He just was like, he was just a tired old sack of bones, you know? It was like after that.
Because
Malloy just came back. And knocked him out and hit him. And I think Malloy Malloy was Malloy. He's aggressive. He's got to stay aggressive, and that's his nature, you know. And, you know, he took a lot of crap from Foley. And, you know, it's just amazing. It always cracks me up that Foley and Republicans always start crying whenever they get hit. But they don't mind hitting anybody else, you know. But the minute they hit, they say, oh, that wasn't fair. You've been so negative, you know. And I just thought it was funny. But I was glad.
Well,
I thought that was a very strong debate, you know. Yeah. So.
See, he started with a very strong debate, his first one, which you didn't see, Lil, which I watched. Which was,
I thought, yeah, I did. I did.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was great. Yeah,
it was,
he
was excellent.
Yeah, he
and
went
then
out.
He softened up a bit in the second one.
Yeah.
But this last one was very strong. And he really revealed, I thought, that Foley really didn't have any plans. I mean, there was nothing that he could come out with that was really solid. And I'm sure that swayed a lot of the independents.
Yes. What do you think, Larry?
I think, well, I want to get back to the debate, actually, because, what I think you saw, what happened during the campaign was, and I give Malloy a lot of credit for it, he really went after, I thought he was aggressive, he was forceful, went for the juggler, but I think we really had, whatever Malloy's faults are, I think you really did have in this race two candidates of diametrically opposed visions for Connecticut. And, Foley is the one truly that, you know, it's almost a cliche now, but he's the 1%. You know, this is a guy who shut down factories, his investments closed down plants, made $40 million while workers were laid off, and jobs got offshored, and he just had no clue, and he rides around in yachts, and he has no clue what people actually have to do to get by on a daily basis. And, you know, to his credit, Malloy does, and I think he exploited that to great advantage. So I think that made a big difference.
And I think those ads, too, I have to say those ads, that last one where we gave everybody a 10-cent raise and then took $40 million. You know, when he sold the company.
That makes an impact
on people.
Yeah,
it makes an impact on people, you know. But, it was true. But I felt, I felt vindicated that Malloy won and that Foley got whatever it was. But I really, really shuddered when I saw the national elections. How did you feel? Were you expecting that, or?
It's certainly not surprised. I mean, only because the forecast seemed to be. There's one guy in particular who I follow, Nate Silver. 538. He is really spot on with a lot of his forecasting. He goes beyond and a little deeper than a lot of the pollsters do. I've lost my capacity. I don't want to come off sounding, snarky here like I knew this was going to happen. I didn't know it was going to happen. But I've stopped being surprised. Because really what happened yesterday was that the people, many of the very people who helped drive this country into a ditch, got reelected and took control of the Senate and the House of Representatives. So I'm no longer surprised anymore. Am I disappointed? Yes. Am I troubled? Am I alarmed? Am I scared? All of the above. But, what's prompting people to vote the way they're voting is beyond me right now.
What did you think of the election of that pig castrating senator?
From Iowa.
that's what I'm talking about. Get these morons who are, winning office with a radical agenda. It's the philosophy, it's the extremist philosophy that got this country into a lot of trouble. And now they're in control. And the Democrats, quite frankly, have to bear some of the blame. They have not found a way to counter this stuff. They've gotten away from, embracing what the unions stand for and what other groups stand for. And so to a certain degree, they may have brought some of this upon themselves. I mean, there's no way we should be in this position that we're talking about tonight with Mitch McConnell, leading the Senate. This shouldn't be happening in this country.
No, I don't think so either. But it's like I don't know. We were listening. Trump even said we played a speech tonight that they voted for. There was a referendum there. There was people wanted a change in the economy, and he said that's what happened. But
yeah, and I don't know that I think that's an oversimplification, though. I really do. I don't pretend to know what the answers are. I'm just really puzzled by what's going on when, again, you know, the extremists that have put this country, have made this mess so much worse, are given control of both chambers of Congress, and you have some of these crazies like the nut job in Iowa. You know, this becomes inexplicable because we have people voting against their own economic interests, quite frankly. You know, we got problems.
I think that it just goes to show you what a good job you guys have done in Connecticut. You obviously got the message out.
Well,
obviously heard the message, thought about it, and voted the correct way.
And thank you for saying that. I think a lot of states too, where there's congressional races, some union people really
worked hard.
There. But boy, I'll tell you this.
I think you guys did a good job in Connecticut.
Thank you.
It was a big push. I think we did too.
I think part of what we did, at least in Connecticut, is, well, you know, look, we have never said Malloy is wonderful and great. He's got a lot of imperfections. What we told our members is, you know, obviously voting is a personal choice, but vote for candidates who support your pay, your retirement, and your health care. And, you know, and if candidates aren't willing to make that commitment, then we shouldn't be supporting them. Now, that doesn't mean they're going to honor that commitment uniformly, but that means we'll also be ready to fight them when they back off on what they say they would do. So, you know, Connecticut is like a sore thumb compared to everything else, you know, for the Republicans. So I think what we accomplished was pretty significant. We kept control of both chambers of the House. We reelected a governor. You know, Scott Walker won pretty easily in Indiana, Rick Snyder in Michigan, Rick Scott in Florida. You know, some real bad guys.
That surprised me too. That really did. Yeah. That these guys could cakewalk through that election. You know, when they were such horrible people. But you know, the unions couldn't beat those guys. You know, they just, you know.
Well, I think you.
I don't understand it. I don't understand that the Republican stronghold in this election. It just floored me. I really did.
Well, I think getting the message out in a simple way that people can understand, and saying it over and over again is very helpful. You said it on paper. You said it in videos. You said it in speeches. And you sent things out to union members. People worked hard to get these people elected, and I think it's great. Thank you.
I wish the Democrats would do that nationally, though.
Yeah,
you know?
I mean,
really. I don't understand why they didn't. And I don't understand. I just don't understand the mindset, you know, of how everybody voted for these Republicans, I don't know. The critique has been that they voted against Obama, and I guess that must be it. They voted against the Obama and agenda and the gridlock and blah blah blah. But the gridlock was also caused by the Republican Party. You know?
Yeah, they don't understand that, and the voters seem to quickly forget what happened under the Bush administration.
Every single Republican administration has caused massive depressions, recessions, economic nightmares, wars, and everything else under Republican administrations and Republican Congresses. And I just can't understand how people forget this, you know?
You just hit your, well, you guys just identified so many of the problems. You know, the very champions of gridlock, you know, being put in power, for all of his failures. What did, you know, Obama's championed a minimum wage increase. He's championed expanding and making healthcare more affordable. And I, you know, it just maybe there's a problem with institutionally with the Democratic Party not willing to get out there and really be aggressive in you know, championing it. You know, we kind of got a gift in Connecticut, right? We got this guy who symbolizes everything that's wrong with the 1%, pretending he could run for office and win and solve Connecticut's problems. And, you know, that I'd like to think this is a blueprint for how we need to behave nationally, because I know you guys get frustrated with, you know, very weak-kneed Democrats who don't want to champion the causes of the working class.
That's right. You know, and you wonder if they really believe in the message, so that when they get down to Washington, they just sit back and enjoy it. They're not, they really don't believe.
You know, go with the flow of corporate greed, you know, like here, Charlie,
yeah.
here, Murphy, or here, whatever, you know, here's a 100,000 to your campaign,
yeah.
You know, vote this
yeah.
way, you know.
You just don't. You
and
just
look,
don't,
they're both the. Yeah, and the White House is blaming, you know, the Democrats, the Senate Democrats blame the White House, and, you know, it's like,
no,
you know,
I
just
know.
Airing their dirty laundry. And meanwhile, the other guys are very disciplined. They don't do that.
No,
that's
but
right.
The sad part is that, you know, most of the backers are the same guys. You know, they're backing the same people, you know.
Mm-hmm.
In this case,
yeah,
I agree. Going to see. I mean, we're going to see more. Whatever the Koch brothers have been backing, we're going to see more of it. You know, they won the election.
One of the comments that did frighten me, though, and I wish I could remember who said it, that the one thing that they feel that's going to come out of this Congress is that Pacific trade.
The Pacific Trade Agreement.
That is going to get passed, because I disagree with Obama on that. He supports it. I'm against it. And the Democrats that were eliminated, that'll make the difference, because the Republicans that came in, they all support that.
But they also support the outsourcing of jobs, or I should say the outsourcing, but the insourcing of jobs. Okay. You know, that's another big corporate thing that's going on. They're importing workers from India and Mexico and Europe and wherever the hell they are, else they are. But they're allowing these visas, and they're importing these jobs that should go to Americans. But you know, it's just a frightening thing.
That prospect kind of scared me. I don't. There's very little of that agreement that I think is good for U.S. for U.S. workers, U.S. people, or the U.S. economy.
What do you feel about that?
I couldn't say it better. I mean, again, I think the problem and the challenge for us is, you know, how do we get the politicians? Because I want to be solution oriented now. You know, I've known you guys a lot of years, and you're raising really serious issues. And the problem is, folks like us are talking about it, but the people in power aren't listening. And we need to, you know, we need to start developing solutions so that these people are actually championing the working class. You know, we have taken a walk on the working class. We've taken a walk on the idea of people having a decent wage, health care, pension, if they want to have a union, the right to vote for that union without intimidation. You know, these things are falling by the wayside. And, you know, and if the Democrats want to keep getting compromised by those same interests you're talking about, you know, we're going to be in trouble. Who's going to stand up for what's right? Who's going to stand up for the dignity of work and workers? I don't know, but I certainly don't intend to, you know, be on the sideline watching it happen.
I don't know. How do you feel about this, Larry? This was a clarion call to the Democratic Party, to the people that are, and to the liberals. And I have to say, the independents were the ones that elected Malloy in this election, you know. And I'm an independent. I always have been since I was 18. But, but I think Malloy, it was a deadlock between Democrats and Republicans there, and the independents were the ones that pulled this this election for Malloy, all right? But I really, really, really believe that this was that this election was a call to all, I don't know if you can say Democrats, but to all liberal-leaning Americans to wake the hell up and not be passive and not be cynical and, realize you're in for a serious, serious fight for the next 2 or 3 years or 4 years. And, this may wind up into, whatever happens, I think we're going to see a serious revolutionary surge, in this country. And, similar to what happened during the Bush years, but even more so now, because I think unless the, I think there was, a 19% approval rating of Congress, all right, this year, all right? And even with a 19% approval rating of the entire Congress, they still voted in Republicans.
Right.
So it didn't make much sense to me. But they were the ones that deadlocked everything. But
what troubles me, and I got to jump in though, is that what we're talking about, and I think we're in agreement, is that so people say they're tired of the gridlock, they're tired of this, they're tired of that, but there are too many people who are, what I would consider working and middle class people who are voting against their economic interest. Voting for Koch brother, funded candidates. They're voting for people who want to strip workers of their rights, who want to give all the money to the rich guys and the corporations. And that's what I'm having trouble with.
I know people that vote that way. And I find that they're attracted by the things that the Republicans wave in front of them. Like the first thing that Foley waved in front of people was, I'm going to cut your taxes.
It's
that really appeals to people. And then, he talks about, I'm going to fix education. But, of course, they never ask anything beyond that. They never find out what the plan is. If you're going to cut taxes, I had this discussion with someone whose husband is actually a state worker, and I said who is a blue-collar Republican, by the way, I think, who said to me that, she was going to vote for Foley, and I said, because he was going to cut some taxes. And I said to her, well, how do you think the state is going to run if you don't have money and you cut taxes and you're not going to raise the taxes on the wealthy and you're going to get a small tax deduction? How do you think they're going to raise the money? And she just looked at me and I said, the first person they'll probably get rid of is someone like your husband, who is a mid-level government employee.
Exactly.
And
exactly.
She was horrified. What do you mean they're going to get rid of him? I said, those are the people they get rid of. They get rid of people in schools. They get rid of people, first responders. Those are the people that go. You don't have any services. I know it was a big thing on TV when Foley talked about not raising taxes and Malloy lied and all that kind of thing. What a terrible human being he was because he lied. I said, quite frankly, I didn't like having my taxes raised at all. I whined and cried with the best of them, believe me. But I mean, the truth was laying people off. And if you're a state employee, you're one of the first people to be threatened by a Republican. But
they're spot on.
They don't hear that.
No, they don't.
Yeah, they're tone deaf.
On the chopping block. You know,
they hear, they think of those reduced, that they're going to get their taxes yeah. reduced. What they don't realize is yeah. they're not the top 1%.
No, they're not the wealthy.
They're going to bear the brunt of all those cuts.
They're the expendable, yeah.
Yeah, we're just the collateral damage in the way to the top for the 1%. That's how mm-hmm. I see myself when someone like that gets elected. You know, and
yep.
neighbor loses their job, or you know the fireman gets laid
yeah.
off, or
yeah.
you lose your job. You know, they don't really think too much about you. You're just in their way for their agenda.
Collateral damage.
Then, you know, that's what they say when they drop a bomb on somebody over in Afghanistan. Well, I feel that way when I get those bombs dropped on me. Anyway, I talk too much.
Like, well said. Well said. Hey, I got to fly. I apologize. This was fun.
No, that's quite all right. And I hope all the guys down there at Council 4 give themselves a deserved pat on the back
yeah.
for all their hard work. You guys.
Thanks. And I appreciate it. And, you know, I'm going to say to Sal, my boss, tomorrow that you guys said that our program may have been a template for the nation, and that he's going to be really glad to hear that.
Well, good. Well, we seriously mean it. I'm very proud
yeah.
to be associated with Council 4 and all
absolutely.
The hard work you
absolutely.
Do.
Good, good. Well, thank you so much, guys.
All right,
Larry.
Good night.
Yeah.
Good. Talk to you in a month. See ya.
Yeah. Good night, guys.
Bye-bye.
And that was Larry Dorman and Council 4 at Aspen Union. Man, I'll tell you, those guys have put a lot of
I think
lot
since
together.
September at least,
really
or don't. The, yeah, since Labor Day.
Oh, yeah.
Larry been on every month, and he would tell us about his week, where he was and what he was doing. And, I mean, he's just one person in that union.
He's their public relations
and
guy.
He's
I mean,
always
he's
everywhere. I think they did a great job.
It's fascinating what they've been able to do, and I appreciate them so much. But they're saving that middle class, you know. And
the other states really can't say that. I mean,
no,
boy.
No, of course not. They can't. They just.
I'm sure they worked hard too.
Yeah, well they did. But you know, overall, it's just.
It's nice to be successful when you work hard. It doesn't always happen.
No, it doesn't. You know. But we want to thank him and want to thank Jasmine for being with us and being our
sponsor
our
here.
Sponsors and our buddies for the last number of years. And it's been tremendous. I wanted to do tonight, what I wanted to do is bring about
we have a few more
other interests here. We might want to go to a quick music break.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea. We have to pull up a few other articles.
A few other things. So we'll be right back after this music break. Yeah. Let's see what we got here. Rubber boots. Here you go, boots. Thank you. possession in California.
Oh, that's good.
California voters just approved Proposition 47, and that is an important step toward ending mass incarceration and the war on drugs. So let's see what that's about, because that's exciting. Passage of Proposition 47 will spare thousands from unnecessary time behind bars and save billions of taxpayer dollars. Overwhelming support sends powerful national message. Today, California voters took a significant step toward ending mass incarceration and the war on drugs by approving Proposition 47. On the heels of reforming the state's three strikes law in the 2012 election, Californians overwhelmingly voted to change six low-level nonviolent offenses, including simple drug possession, from felonies to misdemeanors. The overwhelming support for this reform sends a powerful message nationally, demonstrating that voters are not just ready but eager to reduce prison populations in ways that can enhance public safety. Proposition 47 has the potential to drastically reduce the number of people in state prisons and county jails who don't need to be there for reasons of either justice or safety by making 20,000 current people eligible for resentencing and reducing admissions by 40 to 60,000 every year. That's amazing. But anyway, Proposition 47 does not specifically address marijuana, people with felony records for marijuana possession, which is responsible because possession of marijuana concentrates can be charged as a felony under current law, would be eligible to be resentenced and can also file a petition to expunge or clear their records. That's good news. I think that's good news. Maybe I'm wrong, but I think it's good news. Hillary Clinton might feel like hiding her face in shame after what Rand Paul just masterfully exposed for the whole internet to see. Wow.
Well,
you support Rand Paul's attack on Hillary Clinton? I don't know. I'm curious. I don't know.
I have no idea.
I
think
know.
He's a nut job.
I think he's
though.
A nut job, personally. But
yeah.
Let's see what he did. Yeah.
Rand Paul takes six shots at Hillary Clinton with six images. As Western journalism told you earlier on Wednesday, almost all high-profile Democratic candidates for whom Hillary Clinton campaigned over the last few months were defeated in the midterm elections. Some were soundly defeated. In fact, some of those Clinton losers had been expected to win. On his Facebook page, Kentucky Senator Rand Paul is thought to be seriously a run for the White House in 2 years, was anything but serious as he poked fun at the fact that Hillary Clinton's presence on the campaign trail seemed to be something of a kiss of death in many cases. Paul Page introduced a hashtag called Hillary's Losers, as well as six colorless captioned photos reminding visitors of the former Secretaries of State association with the now defeated Democrats.
So, Hillary Losers.
I don't even know who
that
is.
I don't know who
any of these people are.
No.
That's how little I remember
them. We don't recognize any of these people. So anyway, and he doesn't name them, so it's like, hey, screw you, right? So much for that. Well, typical of Rand Paul.
Oh, here they are.
He doesn't even name them. So what? But, you know, it's typical of Rand Paul. He's an insane guy. He really is.
I can't believe he's contemplating a run for the White House.
Well, what bothers me
scary.
So much about him, he didn't even support his own father. He supported Romney, you know, in that election. Five hilariously stupid reactions by liberals in the media after last night. I don't know what that is, but I have to laugh. Let's see what this says. Broco laughably claimed no big ideological win for GOP. MSNBC host panic on midterms. I don't know what's good news. What good news would be? Okay. As the world crumbles in on the Dems, ABC clings to war on women. Okay. There you have it, folks. Pure liberal media. Okay, well.
It's not much of anything. Very shallow, kind of.
Yeah, just stupid Republican shit that, you know, trying to gloat. But, you know, the thing that bothers me so much isn't so much that, I feel sorry that we had to go to that extent. But.
Yeah.
I really do. Two riders barrel down this water slide of one.
This is kind of scary. Drug makers are pushing for indemnity for fast-tracked Ebola vaccines. So that means they can, while they're trying out the vaccine on people, if there's any repercussions from that, you can't sue them. No. That's kind of scary.
Well, you can't sue any drug company, and you can't sue, you can't even sue Monsanto.
Oh, I know you can't sue Monsanto. According to the World Health Organization, millions of doses of Ebola vaccine should be ready and available next year. Efficacy trials for two different Ebola vaccines are slated to begin in December, as reported by The Verge One. The WHO, that's the World Health Organization, says that there are no plans to begin a mass vaccination program until at least June of 2015, and then only if the growth of the epidemic justifies it. The vaccine industry has a number of hurdles to conquer before they will stand to make a fortune from the Ebola vaccine. Let's see what hurdles they have to jump over, because you know they're going to make a fortune. Let's see. For starters, vaccine manufacturers are demanding indemnity against lawsuits that may arise from the use of fast-tracked Ebola vaccines. Similar to the indemnity claimed by the United Nations, whose peacemakers stand accused of causing the cholera outbreak in Haiti after the 2010 earthquake that devastated the small country. An estimated 700,000 Haitians have contracted cholera, and 8,500 have died from it since the beginning of the outbreak. While the source of the outbreak could not be conclusively determined, a group of Haitians filed a lawsuit against the UN in 2013. A lawyer for the U.S. Justice Department recently called for the case to be dismissed, saying that the UN is absolutely immune to claims of wrongdoing. This is the kind of immunity vaccine makers want as well. But indemnity might not be quite as easy to get as initially thought in this case. Can you trust government agencies and health experts to prevent a deadly pandemic? The federal government may also expect some resistance to mass vaccination programs against Ebola. Considering how the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has bungled the handling of the deadly pathogens in the past and so far clumsily tripped over every Ebola hurdle placed in its path, we probably have more to fear from the federal government than the viruses themselves. Hence, when the federal government arrives at your door saying we are here to help, it's understandable why some might want to run in the other direction. We've also seen public health experts act in ways that really raise questions about their ability to give sound advice in a pandemic situation. NBC News chief medical correspondent Nancy Snyderman, for example, was exposed to Ebola while on assignment in Liberia. She and other members of her team were supposed to stay in quarantine for 21 days, but decided to break their quarantine to get some takeout. Writing for KevinMD.com, Barbara Fakira notes, her actions for violating the quarantine are unacceptable and very disconcerting. As a medical communicator, her role is to provide accurate, credible, and trustworthy health information to the public and to demonstrate good, sound judgment. Dr. Snyderman basically showed the world that it's okay to dodge the rules at your own discretion. She had no regard for her role as a medical communicator. As a health professional, Dr. Snyderman may be confident that she posed no risk to the public, but as a medical communicator, she demonstrated disregard to any rules and made them her own. Unlike Snyderman...
They got something more important. I don't like the Snyderman. I don't care about
her.
Well,
I'm just saying that
she's... She's a media whore.
Well, she's being criticized. They've criticized her.
She's a media whore, which is good. Yeah. This is something, I thought this was interesting, because we only got 4 minutes left. Glenn Greenwald and Snowden, nobody should use Facebook. What do you think of that? You think Snyderman's more important?
No, just go ahead.
I think Snyderman's a whore. Doesn't matter. Okay. During a Q&A in Canada, Glenn Greenwald was asked why his colleague and NSA whistleblower, Edward Snowden, wasn't on any of the social media platforms, Facebook and Greenwald, didn't mince words. He doesn't use Facebook because he hates Facebook, he says, as one of the worst violators of privacy in history. Nobody should use Facebook. I'm reading this from Facebook, actually. Greenwald did add that despite the difficulties of being the most wanted man in the world right now, he thought Snowden would be an engaging presence on Twitter should he choose to go in that direction. Snowden practically lives his life online these days. He added, and actually before all of this happened, before anyone knew Edward Snowden, it's what he did anyways. And ironically, his Russian exiles has enabled Snowden to engage in public life and continue speaking about American mass surveillance, rather than being condemned to this life of dankness and dark misery. He's become a real important voice in debate where he helped to catalyze, and he's really happy about it. But he says, don't use Facebook. It's the worst thing you could possibly do. What do you think of that?
What's his thing?
Well, he's a spy guy, you know. You want to read this one? Election Day scandal.
Let's see what it is. Explosive Election Day scandal in toss-up states. With just hours until the polls close in the very tight New Hampshire U.S. Senate race, newly revealed memos indicate incumbent Democrat Jeanne Sheehan was in direct communication with one of Obama's most trusted IRS officials about increasing the agency's scrutiny of conservative organizations applying for tax-exempt status. And the chairwoman of New Hampshire's Republican Party says the news is reverberating across the Granite State. People are talking about it all over the state, of course. It's shocking to see that our own United States Senator, Jeanne Sheehan, engaged in this sort of behavior using a federal agency, the IRS, to target American citizens for their political beliefs, said New Hampshire GOP Chairwoman Jennifer Horn. We haven't seen anything like this, as you know, since the Nixon era. It's shocking and disappointing to all of us here in New Hampshire. The memos obtained by the Dallas Caller show that Sheehan was in direct contact with IRS Chief Counsel William J. Wilkins, who has previously been labeled the president's man of the IRS. It appears the contact started in March 2012 when Sheehan wrote to Wilkins on behalf of a small group of Democratic senators, including Chuck Schumer of New York and Al Franken of Minnesota. In the letter, Sheehan aggressively urged Wilkins and others of the IRS to change the standards by which groups self-identifying as social welfare organizations would be judged for tax-exempt status. According to the Daily Caller, the senator calls for setting limits on political spending for the groups and mandating that a majority of total spending must be on non-political matters. She also wanted the IRS to get much more detailed information about how the groups were financed and place restrictions on how much donations to the organizations could be written off. Well, if they're supposed to be helping people...
Hey, yeah, really.
And they turn out to be dumping money into political organizations, I think it's right that
they should be looked at. Those groups that we saw in Connecticut, all those groups that were saying, you know, all these negative ads.
Money was pouring into these candidates.
And they were against Foley and against Malloy, but they were independent groups that said they didn't know who they are.
You can't find out where that money comes from either. You don't know who's behind that.
Somebody,
they have protection.
I don't think that's right. I don't either.
I'm not outraged at this at all. I think they should be looked at.
I really do. I really don't think
it's right.
Yeah, you gotta know.
Sorry.
Anybody can throw money at somebody, and you know.
Yeah, if they want to throw money, I want to know where it's from. I don't think they should be throwing it. I think we should have campaign financing.
Did you know an 18-year-old girl just won an election?
Liz the trashing Sarah Blair, an 18-year-old.
Yeah, 18-year-old girl just won an election. Conservative. Sarah Blair, an 18-year-old Republican, who just won a seat in the West Virginia legislature. Wow.
A West Virginia University freshman who did most of her campaigning out of her dorm room became the youngest state lawmaker in the nation Tuesday. Republican Sarah Blair, a fiscally conservative 18-year-old, will represent a small district in Western Virginia's Eastern Panhandle, about 1.5 hours outside of Washington, D.C. I wonder if she's from Charlestown or Martinsburg or one of those. Yeah, West Virginia's Eastern Panhandle, about 1.5 hours outside Washington, D.C., after defeating her Democratic opponent, 68%.
Wow, she slaughtered her.
I'm surprised because a lot of the people that live out there commute to Washington and they could be government workers.
Wow.
According to the Associated Press, a third candidate got 7% of the vote. In a statement, Ms. Blair thanked her supporters and family, as well as her opponents, for running a positive campaign. History has been made tonight in West Virginia, and while I am proud of all that we have accomplished together, it is the future of this state that is now my singular focus, she said. Ms. Blair campaigned on a pledge to work to reduce certain taxes on businesses, and she also holds anti-abortion and pro-gun positions. She defeated Democratic Lane Deal, a 44-year-old Martinsburg attorney, whose top priorities included improving secondary education and solving the state's drug epidemic.
How awesome is that? That's amazing.
Well, let me tell you, though,
18.
The guy can't, the her opponent, he's got it right. That section of West Virginia is being destroyed by drugs.
Oh, really?
Because when I talked to my daughter, who lives in D.C., about maybe relocating to that part of the country, she said, you don't want to live there because the drugs are such a problem in that area.
Well, it says here, top priorities including improving secondary education.
That was her opponent.
The drug epidemic, yeah.
That was her opponent.
She's not interested.
Won.
My God,
yeah.
She still won by
63%. Well, they're all on drugs. What do you think?
Transdimensional travel. Good night, everyone.